welcome to Intersections. We aspire here to help you dissolve boundaries, to be able to identify and access your highest potential by being always looking for opportunities through which to go beyond your sector, your domain, your identity, your profile into what vaster possibilities exist beyond. And today, I'm delighted that we will be taking on that conversation from a very unique lens, and that's the lens of sports, and in particular within sports, Formula One racing. What do you and I have to do with Formula One racing? What is it that we can glean and learn and find common ground with the race car drivers who pursue that sport? We are going to be able to unpack that and much more with the beautiful contributions of Robbie Anderson. Robbie is a highly experienced performance psychologist and renowned attention expert, specializing in high-performing people, teams, and cultures. As an expert in applied neuroscience and high-stakes environments, Robbie has personally collaborated with the CHIMP model. We'll talk more about that. With the CHIMP model created by Professor Steve Peters for over a decade, co-founding and running a successful consultancy together called CHIMP Management. Robbie is now a director at Performing Minds, supporting elite performers in sports and business, and is the head of psychology at Hinsa Performance, consulting to drivers and teams in Formula One racing. I had an opportunity to get to be acquainted with Robbie's work through a beautiful article that came in the New York Times about exactly the kind of topic that we're grounding our conversation in today. What is it that you and I can learn from the mystique and magic of Formula One racing? And Robbie had some beautiful insights and thoughts which related so much to the kind of work that I've been aspiring and advancing in the world of business and leadership that I thought, my heavens, Robbie is somebody I want to get to know. And in doing so, why don't I allow you all as well, our dear listeners and our community, to get to know him as well. So what a joy to have you in our midst. Welcome, Robbie.
Thanks very much. Thanks for welcoming me on. It's really good to join and have some time together now.
Yeah, beautiful. So listen, I'm super intrigued. And so I'm going to ask you this question just off the gate. And then I want to come back and unpack a little bit sort of your journey in getting there. But just as sort of like one inquiry, you're working with these Formula One racers. I mean, you know, when I think about them, you know, naively in my own sort of very simplistic way, I think about, okay, I drive a car. And then these people really do that as a profession, and they take it to the ultimate limits, and they're even doing it in a way which is like, wow, so much on that edge where a slight little miscalculation or error can just be the difference between life and death and so much more, not just winning and losing. In that context, you come in as a psychologist. What's the nature of that relationship between you and the driver? How open and receptive are they to having a professional, having Robbie come in and sort of like tell them, hey, listen, there are a few things about your own mind that I'm in a position to help support you and serve you and, you know, open you up to. And if you did, that could make you so much better at that thing, which maybe I could never do, but I can help you take your game to the next level. You know, I'm just curious. What opens them up to that kind of a collaboration with you?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question to consider, I think, from the two sides. One is as the practitioner going into work in these, I guess, privileged environments. And the other one is for anybody out there thinking, you know, what would be the benefits of engaging, whether it's a psychologist or a therapist or a spiritual coach. So to answer your question directly, my experience of Formula One drivers has been, they are so driven, pun not intended there, they're so driven to fulfill themselves and obviously their ambitions when they explore all of the avenues that they can maximize. So whether that's a physical exploration of how to, you know, get the optimal neck strength so they can tolerate the G-force, whether it's nutrition and the right times to fuel themselves over a race weekend, as you know, huge demands on the body. Of course, it's going to leave quite an important area, which is, you know, how do we look at decision making, the ability to maximize your mind for handling pressure, even just for taking information on. And you start to multiply that by other factors, such as you become, I don't think celebrity is the word they would want, but obviously you become a person of profile. You're probably your own business in your own right, or a small team around you. But the demands on them become really quite significant. And therefore, as I said, when they're keen to explore all these areas of, let's just call it, you know, sports science, or the mind seems like a no-brainer. So that was my experience. They were very receptive. It was often that they came looking for the service. And my relationship with Hinsa is that Hinsa is a very trusted and recognized sports science and medicine provider within that industry. And therefore, when they come to Hinsa, they might actually be looking for a whole package. but they might actually support the coach and some nutrition and some psychology. And that way they know that they're going to optimize their potential in their sport.
And in working with them, have you found that there are certain practices and habits that clearly differentiate, you know, those who rise to the top versus those who are good but not great? You know, there's a whole body of work that was done by a few psychologists, perhaps you're aware of that, you know, around the science of deliberate practice, for example, and, you know, who becomes world champion versus national champion but not world champion, you know, or something like that. You know, at that, you know, very rarefied level of high performance in the sport, are you able to differentiate those inputs that people are taking on as a determinant to the outputs of the performance, you know, quite logically, or do you think it becomes a little bit sort of a random luck of the draw as well?
From my experience of this, you've probably got two things to consider. The first thing is, can we look at that person as an individual? You know, let's actually meet them as an individual. Let's assess, you know, their strengths. Let's have a look at some of the areas they can already identify that they would need to improve. Maybe that's from feedback or from their own experiences. And then also there's kind of blind spots that maybe they just haven't had any awareness raised of areas they can explore and optimize. So it's very much individual first. I wouldn't say that every single Formula One driver approaches something in a set way and that's how the rest of the world should prepare. I think, I hope you all agree, too generalized now. So very individual. What I can then, the second layer of it is that when you look at their willingness, as I said, to engage, so actually looking at pre-race preparation, what's the optimal way to prepare pre-race? What kind of challenges are we having there? How do we optimize them in race? What's the best way? I mean, Formula One was unique for me coming into it as well, because in many of the other sports, there's a bit more time than splits of a second. You know, even on a rugby pitch or a football pitch, or American football pitch, a golf, it tends to be a little bit longer to apply these skills. But when you're going 200 miles an hour into a corner, battling somebody for position, the radio's in your ear, your steering wheel has 35 buttons. There's a lot to process to then apply mental skills. So you've got the pre-race, in-race, but then also really important area is post-race. So when people come out of the car, are they able to engage really well with the team? Can they regulate the emotion of a race quick enough to actually remember it? You know, are they able to communicate that to an engineer and look at how they can change car performance? Are they then able to recover off the back of night one of a Grand Prix? So that post-race, again, is really, really important. And then the final one of the four that I look at is recharge, the ability to finish a Grand Prix in Melbourne, Australia, and then in a week later you're going to be in Japan, and you've got to do all that travel and all the preparation, but you still need to recharge. Now those four areas are where, if we can help that person optimize themselves, the opportunities are obviously very, very, very vast and are very, very, very unique. You know that everyone's going to have different strengths in different areas.
Yeah, I love that four-part structure, and I'd love to actually spend a few minutes unpacking that with you. But let's kind of zoom out for a second and look at the arc of your own personal journey. What sort of led you to this place where this is the kind of work that you're doing? What drew you to sports? What drew you to Formula One racing and the underlying psychology of it?
Yeah, I mean, we're probably going well back into early stuff. So, I mean, I just love sport. I always was very, you know, if you gave me a choice to be out on a sports pitch chasing a football or throwing a javelin, then I would quite happily go and do that. Very sporty parents. So I think, again, you know, there's a kind of maybe there's a role modeling, but also just social situation on holiday. You know, if we're away and as a family, then we're probably having a tennis competition or something. So certainly grew up in a really sporty family and loved sport. Unfortunately, had some pretty awful run of luck in my later, kind of late teens when I was playing very, very good level of rugby. I had multiple reconstructions of my knee. I had three reconstructions of my knee, which is, most people say one's not great, two, probably a career ender, three was early retirement. So I had this kind of pivotal moment. I had a moment where, not, I don't mean this as a sob story, just kind of matter of fact, it was a very difficult moment of life, because obviously my identity, my enjoyment, my ambition was all tied up in sport. And I thought to myself, I'm going to stay in sport. I knew I wanted to stay in sport, but I didn't really know what it was going to be. So I went to university to study a general degree in psychology, because I was very interested in it. And then I got interested in sports science whilst I was there. And then I just converged on this idea of sports psychology. I just liked the idea that I could apply all of the psychology social psychology, criminology, all of the good general psychology you learn when you practice psychology. But I found this niche that I thought I could apply it, and it related probably to some of my earlier kind of core. So even now, fast track, you know, many years later, multiple sports and some really good privileges, I think now I still engage with people with the energy and enthusiasm of, you know, that world. You know, I still kind of see it as that. However, I also now recognize that when I go into a corporate world, as long as I can just slightly change my frame of reference, you know, if you're working with a trader and their analysis of what could be a, you know, good trade position or the risk, and, you know, and then they get a team, and now they've got an economist helping them out, and then they've got a couple of other quantitative, and now there's this team, and they're going to try and achieve this performance. I can buy into that as well. You know, I can really relate to that as well. So I found my core is probably something like adventure and curiosity, certainly a competitive drive in there. But then the professional side from the psychology over the year, I think also has just taught me to, I've obviously got to try and manage myself and be stable and be able to help people when they're in high pressure, turbulent environments. You see what I mean? I'm not there to be a fan. I'm not there to cheer and say, hey, this is Formula One. And the reason I've come to Formula One now was almost reverse engineered. And to be honest, it's come the other way. It's come to me. You know, I've just worked in sport, stayed in sport. And then it's had this opportunity to work with some drivers, and it's just exponentially increased, really. So it's not like I always said, I'm going to go to Formula One as a fan. It's that I've just loved sport. And to be honest with you, probably my biggest passion is people.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for sharing that. I feel like you've given us a really great sort of through your personal example illustration of the forging a purpose in one's life, and how there are twists and turns and unpredictable things. And sometimes life deals a card to you that you're not really seeking or wanting, and yet you have to adapt to it. And who knows what new vistas and doors it opens for you. And so you mentioned the injuries and how they sort of limited your own pursuit of perhaps competitive sports as a professional path that maybe could have otherwise continued to be your path. And yet what it has led to is your ability to multiply the impact and performance of so many, you know, in the sports world, beyond just what you may have delivered yourself, and then going beyond that as well. And in that beyond, just so that our listeners and I can understand the full range, what are the different kinds of profiles of professionals that you've been sort of finding to be, the places where this psychology of pursuing excellence and high performance and the practices that you honed really apply very effectively and well? You mentioned trading a little bit.
It was a kind of a fortuitous point in my journey. I'd super early on, I'd kind of volunteered to go and do, you know, workshops for an Olympic sport, and that had been well received. And then they offered me a paid position. So I kind of, was going back the next year and delivering more. And then once the Olympics came around, I was quite embedded in this team. And once that Olympics finished, because you now was in Olympic sport, it kind of feels like you're in it and you've got a bit of credibility. There's an opportunity to move to another Olympic sport. Now, this second Olympic sport was a sport of Taekwondo. And I knew very little about it. It wasn't a sport that I could practice a lot of. Goes back to your point earlier, you know, what can I teach a Formula One driver? At the end of the day, I've never even driven a Formula One car, but of course it's the convergence of the right stimulus, you know, whether that's mindset or strategies, support, challenge, it's that stimulus that exponentially increases somebody. So I go to Taekwondo, and luckily for me, British Taekwondo is on this side of the road in Manchester, and British cycling is on the other side of the road in Manchester. You're like a stone's throw apart from each other. And at that time, Sir Dave Brailsford, who led the British Olympic cycling program from not the most successful program to certainly one of the most successful in British history, he'd got a psychiatrist. He'd got a forensic psychiatrist, and he was interested in what support the psychiatrist could offer to some riders. He'd had some riders sent. It was off-site, and they'd come back, and they seemed to be in a really good place. So that was the moment for me to meet this psychiatrist. We met at a service station, which was, you know, like a gas station in the UK, which was the only place we could arrange to meet. And we sat down, and straight away, he grilled me on my knowledge. It was like not very many airs and graces, you know, kind of tell me about what you studied and what do you understand about the brain? And I remember kind of doing my best. And then they got out a napkin. It was the only thing we had to hand. Got out a napkin and we had a pen. And he drew his model of the brain. He said, right, you're right with this, and we simplified the brain. Now, when I sat, that was Professor Steve Peters, you know, like you said earlier, the creator of the chimp model. When I sat there, two things happened. One is I thought, I can use this. Like, I can use this myself. You know, I can use this model. And the second thing was I thought, this is going to be really helpful for my work. And since that moment with Steve, I think the journey, because of the success of the chimp model and the book, the people who came to the company were so diverse. You know, the sectors that we were able to support were very, very diverse. So that for me was like a fast track of learning, but also of experience, because, you know, the military would come, or sports sector would come, or, you know, high performing businesses would come, general public would come. So that, I think, exponentially increased me, you know, solid foundation, good support structure, and lots of exposure to different places. So I feel like I've probably worked with a good spread of society, really.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, I'm reminded a little bit about a couple of folks we were speaking about, you know, who also populate the same space. And, you know, I love the way sort of, you know, this work tends to show itself as so valuable and effective across domains. You know, we talked about Owen Eastwood, Michael Gervais, both coming from the sports world, but also, you know, traversing these other professions. I'm also reminded of, you know, someone I've been a little bit out of touch with, but is a dear friend, Josh Waitzkin. Did you ever?
No. Please tell me more.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to find a way to send you a copy of his book. His book is called The Art of Learning. And Josh was the U.S. junior chess champion when he was a teenager. And he almost became the world champion, except he was beaten by, you know, this Russian young boy, you know, at that age. And then he left chess after being a little bit jaded, you know, just by the competitive sort of like push towards wanting to just win. And so he takes a break, you know, in life. And then he gets to be drawn to push hands Tai Chi. He ends up sort of in his 20s becoming good at push hands Tai Chi, ultimately going to Taiwan and becoming world champion in Tai Chi. And after that, he ends up sort of stepping back and analyzing the psychology of sort of what it takes to, you know, create high performance, and then goes and works with the a few hedge funds and in New York and all of that. And I think he's since then taken a break and is probably reinventing himself in some new direction, just knowing the kind of person he is. But it's so admirable, you know, to see that capacity to pick up a, you know, a skill set that can be used to accelerate and advance performance across so many different domains. Cause it kind of like almost is like the universe whispering to us that fundamentally we are all tapping into the same universal laws of human nature. There are some universal laws of human nature.
I agree. And that's not, I mean, that is absolutely not to say that there's some magic formula. You know, it's not like, yeah, I have this cookie cutter, you know, you send me anybody and we'll optimize their performance. You know, that's, I mean, personally, that's not the way I've ever worked. But it does show you that if we can engage with people, if we can explore truly what they want, what is it they really want, they might not always know that. And then we have to explore that a little bit more. And then we can start to look at what it's going to take. And again, are they aware of that? Or do we have to help bring their awareness to a higher level on that? And then, of course, there's a supporting the person to be who they want to be type of objectives. And sometimes it's more doing what they want to do. And those two things also interlink. So there's these layers that you, I guess, you start to have in your head that you can explore with people, and it makes it very relevant to where they're at. You know, like the average person who listens to the podcast or is out there in the street today, they have an objective that they're trying to get done, whether it's that day or whether it's half a year or a couple of years. Everybody's going about it. Everyone's trying to progress in what's important to them. And to have a relationship with somebody that you can be honest about that, and then you can get some feedback and you can make some plans and you can start to build momentum. And again, sometimes have support that would improve anybody. It's like a no-brainer, again, why the elite levels really go after that. You know, why they embed psychologists in sports teams, why F1 drivers have their own psychologists. That's because, as we've just said, it would be helpful to anybody.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, we may or may not have the luxury of having a Robbie in our, you know, careers and in our lives, but you have it for today. You have Robbie here with you for today to our listeners, right? And so, Robbie, if you're open to it, can you give us a little bit of a glimpse as to what that, you know, set of practices is about? And I'm thinking maybe, you know, you mentioned this beautiful moment, you know, in the gas station with Professor Steve, right? So maybe you could start with that, like this chimp model. What is this chimp model, and how does it sort of give us an understanding about human behavior?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Steve's work is out there in his book. So he's got the Chimp Paradox, which is his book, and would be a good starting place for anybody who wants a deeper dive than my quick overview now. But essentially, the chimp model is an access model into our mind. So Steve's a psychiatrist, a consultant psychiatrist, a medical doctor, and studied really medicine and how the brain operates. And he was looking many, many years of research, you know, from when the ability to functionally scan our brains was progressing, then our ability to really understand, and I'm going to put a big caveat in there, in that we're still learning a lot. You know, we absolutely don't understand the brain, by far the most complex system we've got, and we're learning a lot about it, but it was improving. You know, we could see there was localization of certain behaviors. You know, if you damage certain parts of the brain, that it started to show up. For example, memory can be damaged in certain parts of the brain, and we can't remember certain episodic memories, or language can be, you know, motor. So when Steve was looking at that, he started to think, okay, I can see these different systems. And he simplified it down in his working model to three systems. So many, many people will be familiar of the idea of having a strong emotional center from an evolutionary perspective, you know, very instinctual, very impulsive, fight, flight, freeze. You know, so we've really got this instinctual survival system. And Steve looked at the neuroscience and he realized that that was actually quite similar as a system to what the actual chimpanzee possesses. And when we look at some of the behaviors of humans, let's say under stress, or when our primary drives, our territory, whether that's physical or psychological, our food, you know, if we are very, very hungry for periods of time, when we start to see people in that light, and we can all reflect when we're probably in chimp mode. You know, we can probably recognize when our chimp is out. We can recognize how our thinking shifts, how our behavior shifts. You know, if you take over somebody on the motorway and you do it very respectfully, but then there's a traffic jam and you can kind of look around and you'll see quite a lot of what we might call the more chimp-driven behavior. You know, there'll be some banging of the steering wheel and some kind of expletives going on. So without oversimplifying it, it's to recognize that within our brains is independent circuits that we don't control. You know, we do not have direct control over the orbitofrontal cortex. It tends to go before our more rational, logical thinking. So it's almost pre-conscious thought. We're looking at body language. We're making assessments. We're hungry before we even know it. And then we just think, oh, I'm hungry. So the body and the brain are massively connected to keep us alive and keep our species alive. Secondary to that, if I was to put that in the middle of the brain, in the limbic and other areas, secondary to that, we've developed fantastic higher level functioning as a human being in our ability to reflect, our ability to plan, our ability to regulate. So often we'd ask people to get a piece of paper and just write down, who are you at your best? And people would write down who they are at their best. And that would be truly reflective, coming from the higher circuits. So that would be the, as Steve called, the human circuits. That's you. That's the real you. And the biggest thing he would teach people is that you and the chimp realistically are best friends. Many people would see that as a rival, but you're not. You know, the chimp has got an agenda, which is to keep you alive and to fulfill its drives. And it will keep offering you emotions and thoughts along that line. But it's your job to take care of it. And at times to say, yeah, we're worried about giving this speech to a large audience. And that's understandable from the perspective of the jungle, because there's high risk. We don't know who's out there. We could be attacked. But actually, in this situation, I want to give this talk. It's more aligned with what I believe is important. It's a values-based talk to a school group. So all of a sudden, another chimp settles down because I've reassured it. So that was a great metaphor of Steve's model. Very simple, scientifically quite well-grounded. But he had this third system, which was what really hit it for me in sport. His third system, he, again, metaphorically called a computer. And the idea that we can store, program, experiences, memories, behaviors, patterns over our lifetime. So when I looked at sport, I started to think, well, what mode are people in to perform at their best? You know, which system do we really want to be in? And obviously for an athlete who might want to be very automatic, 100 meter sprint, for example, would probably want to be very computer, very automatic, not actually much analysis going on, not unnecessary distracting emotions. So a lot of that work would be to getting them into computer mode, getting into flow state, as is more commonly known. But actually in other scenarios, I'd want to be in human mode. I'd want to be reflecting, why isn't my season going well? And is this the right coach for me? And let's do an analysis, let's interview some people. So you can start to shift between the three. And that was where I thought, this will be powerful.
So when you describe these different sort of parts of the brain, you know, it's sort of, you know, I link it to something that I've been sort of modeling for leadership, which is to think about leadership and performance at work as a state, not a trait. You know, in other words, it's not that some people have it, some don't have it, or you don't have it, you have to retrofit it and acquire it. But it's sort of like sometimes you enter that state. And when you're in that state, then, you know, you're in a position to bring goodness and creativity and courage and, you know, all of the good things that we need, you know, as a leader. And sometimes you're not in that, you know, state. So I'm kind of curious about, you know, seeing if you can relate to that idea of state versus trait.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, two things, actually. One is, first and foremost, that the neuroscience, when we look at the neuroscience of the brain and how it's operating at certain points, it's very, very complex. But we can also see that too much emotion in key moments tends to increase error rate. You know, when people are maybe over intense or over forcing something, you know, we see high activation, but at the same time, we do see an increase of error rate. So at the same time, when we see people to be quite relaxed and get themselves, again, kind of topically called flow state, but they're there, they're very present, they're very task focused, we'll see lots of brain activity. It's not like the brain's turned off, but now we see a higher success rate. So what I'm always interested in is, how do we help people recognize what that state is like for them and get them into that state more often than not? And the neuroscience would seem to suggest that that's to do with which systems we're in and how we get good at shifting between them. So for me, it's to remind everybody that this ability to manage your mind is not a trait. You know, the myth that high performers are just wired differently. They were born with the ability to do these things really well. That's the myth. I see is people investing time into learning like mind models. They understand the mind and how it might react. They explore their own mind and they say, okay, what does my mind do under pressure situations? What are my triggers? You know, what are my typical coping behaviors? And then they say, okay, what could I try new? You know, do I need to rethink that situation? Do I need to look at how I regulate emotion in the moment? Do I look at new habits that help me do that? You know, a Formula One driver is managing their emotions, their decision-making, their relationships in this pressure cooker, but they're working on it. You know, that they're proactively working on that with a feedback loop. So I completely agree with you. It is about getting in the right state, but I often think that's a skill, you know, that people could work on.
Yeah. Wonderful. So you mentioned these four parts of the Formula One racer's journey, right? I'm trying to relate it to how we might sort of think about it for, you know, for a leader, for an executive, for, you know, for any professional, right? And so, and I think it like sort of like maps really well, right? So you talk about the pre-race, and that's, you know, before critical events, you know, that come up for, you know, for a manager or leader, for example, critical meetings, conversations, presentations, decision-making moments, what have you. So the pre, you know, the pre part, then there's the actual race. So that's the moment you're in those interactions that you need to step your performance up to a good level for. Then you talk about the post-race, and then you talk about, I think you called it the recharging. Yeah, is that right? Yeah. So I like that. I mean, I think those four could easily apply to executive life as well. Is that how, you know, is that what you've seen as well in some of your work outside the car racing world? And, you know, I just want to kind of freeze the model, you know, first between us, and then if we could unpack what you see as winning practices in each of those, that would be great. But yeah, do you see this equally applying to other?
I really do. You know, I really do. I think, like I said, it's a simple framework, you know, and also it's one that's realistically been around for a long time. You know, if we think about plan, do, review, you know, that's I don't know who owns that. I'd probably, you know, be struggling now to find if that was one author that had that idea, but we'd go back and have a look. So I think the simple premise is preparation.
Yeah.
You know, but then obviously the level of preparation that people do for events can have a big indicator on success. So if you're a corporate professional and you've got a big project coming up, your ability to be really clear of what the goal is. So if you break down each one, so if you're preparing for it, you know, what is the goal here? You know, what are our focus points here? You know, what are we trying to really achieve with this project or with this delivery or with this interaction? Then we might do some scenario planning. You know, how could it play out? What are our options? You know, if it's the board meeting, you know, who's in the room and what typically do I need to, how do I engage with those people differently? What's the messaging? You know, right into kind of
is my deck ready? And are my key messages ready? What resources do or don't we need? So I think that that idea of pre is often about preparation and planning. Also what we see in sport, and I think we do see it certainly in other domains, but to a higher level of popularity in sport, we see more simulation.
Right.
So in Formula One, they have simulator cars, basically a kind of interactive virtual reality. You know, so we're familiar with virtual reality nowadays. You're sat in the car, the track is being fed into your brain, and you're maybe doing that track 50, 60, 70, 80 times with slightly different, I don't know, a wet condition put on, or, you know, different wind condition. So what you're doing is you're training your brain, you're simulating the experience. Now, visualization has been popular in sport for a long time as well, where right. we think about different situations on the pitch and how I'm going to respond to that. And therefore, I'm priming my brain, I'm priming the circuits which are more automated to kick in the moment. Yeah. So when you think about right from the goal into the scenarios, into the simulation and imagery, and then the last part for me, pre-phase, is probably around energy management.
Right.
So you've done your preparation and it might be 2 days now before the delivery. And the work is done. You know, I think in Olympic world, if you're really trying to add any more preparation 2 days before you compete, that would suggest to me that really we should accept now. You know, you've got more chance of injuring yourself than you have of finding the kind of miracle in 2 days. So now we need to manage the energy. And in Formula One, because the turnarounds are so tight, there comes a window where actually the best thing you can now do is down-regulate. You know, yeah. the Formula One car is not sat on the track on a Wednesday with somebody revving its engine, burning its fuel and rubber. Yeah. So we can't get that with the driver, you know? So some athletes, 100%, will believe that they prefer a hype approach to perform better. You know, don't talk to me from Wednesday to Saturday because I'm in game mode. Mm. And I am not here to say whether that's right or wrong. I'm saying some people like to do that. Somebody else will say, well, I just burn out doing that. Mm. I need to better tune in at the key moment and tune out. So that and that is all still pre-phase. What do you think? Does that seem relevant to the corporate world as well?
I like very much the different components of that. And I think, you know, everybody would say that they end up doing some preparation around the technical and functional aspect of the spreadsheet and the PowerPoint and the content of what they... But then there is the human side to it as well, which I found sometimes that we are lacking in really thinking through in advance what are the different opinions and reactions and sentiments that might get unleashed when I say this or say that, and what baggage is somebody bringing in, or what's my past history in that relationship, and therefore what's the right way for me to simulate an approach like this scenario, that scenario. So some of what you're saying, I think, is a stepping up to a new level of rigor. But certainly in, you know, in some recent research I've done around this idea of sort of how do we get to accelerated performance in the workplace, I found that even just taking 10 minutes to do some of the preparation you're talking about, which is done in a much more rigorous way and more thoroughly and a time invested way in Formula One racing from what you've said, but just even 10 minutes of a little bit of this in advance of the meeting, I found to be very helpful. Now, there's one practice that I found very, very useful in the business world. I'm curious about how you relate to it or not. And that is the setting of a positive intention. In other words, checking in with yourself that you're not approaching that, you know, let's say that race, right, or that meeting or that conversation from a place of nervousness or lack of confidence or a frustration or you know, just some intention which can, you know, at times just limit you from being able to see possibilities, seeing capacities and being more joyfully and zestfully sort of involved in it rather than, you know, again, approach it from a place of jadedness or, you know, or just kind of frustration or something. So and now I imagine in Formula One racing, there's maybe that positive intention just comes from the passion people have for car racing anyway. But have you found it helpful to at times allow people to introspect a little bit? Like, what's your relationship with, you know, with this particular race and, you know, your past history with it or the other players who are going to be there, racers and anyway?
100% important because, of course, sport is another example whereby situations can emerge that would make the person feel a little bit limited. So for example, you know, you might be in a car and the performance of the car hasn't been as effective as you maybe desired. And therefore, if you're not careful, the brain starts to fulfill that kind of narrative that we're in a limited car. And you know, if you're not careful, the most extreme would be like, what's the point? There's no driver or athlete that I've ever met that says, what's the point before they play? I think they're too highly driven for that because they're too competitive. But it does show you that ability to say, come on, what is this race weekend about then? If we're not racing for podium, what is it about? And they might say, right, it's about championship points. It's about finishing, you know, sixth or fifth. Maybe it's about, right, I'm really going to push the car this weekend because we need to know its limits. The engineers need to find out. You're re-engaging them in that idea that the motivation becomes intrinsic again. It's their drive to learn, to push, to compete. And as long as they can reframe that, you're totally right. I think in sport, just like in business, where you think to yourself, right, I've had a rotten run of form. You know, things haven't gone my well. The last three projects have, you know, proposals have been turned back. If you're not careful, the narrative comes, well, this is going to be the fourth. And that can obviously bleed into your demeanor and your delivery and therefore perhaps writes your success. But if you can get that chance to stop,
yeah,
maybe go back to really what you're about and you can reconnect with what you're about. And often most people will find some direction in their core. You know, who am I really? What is success really about for me in life? And in those questions, people tend to want to grow. They want to have a go, or they want to provide maybe for family. And they reconnect with that and they say, right, actually, do you know what? It's about me putting my hat in the ring and going again. You know, it's dusting off. Let's go again. Fourth time lucky with the board. So I think the parallels are there.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. I love the visualization, you know, and scenarios. And it sounds like, of course, you have very advanced technology in the Formula One racing world. It's interesting because I've been working on building, you know, a more humble version of that for the business world, which is by using AI to do rapid simulations of role plays, you know, of like, you know, once you feed it in, but like, here's the context, you know, here are the stakeholders I'm meeting and here's what's at stake here. It just auto-generates, you know, different scenarios. What if this? What if this? What if this? And you respond to it and then it scores you, you know, and tells you like, here's how I would actually, you know, score how effective you are at empathizing or at pivoting to a new direction based on what you just heard or something. And so anyway, so I see possibilities today, you know, of being able to bring in some of that kind of discipline as well for those, you know, if you want to call it corporate athletes, right, who are really keen and invested in wanting to up their game.
Oh, honestly, I mean, that sounds so interesting. I would love to see that because when we used to do Olympic preparation close, so you had your 4 years, you know, you had a European championships, world championships, and, you know, and all these qualifiers, and eventually you're getting into the close, we'd always pick an optimal window where we'd have an Olympic simulation day. I say the optimal window because you want to do it near enough that it has a relevancy and obviously you're at peak form, but obviously you also don't want to get everybody injured. So the greatest challenge of simulation is making it realistic enough that your brain gives you the same possible stress responses that you have on the day. Those scenarios were always very good because we'd get people fighting against, you know, other people maybe who weren't selected. So there's that bit of rivalry. That was a great one in Taekwondo. But in the trading world, in the hedge fund world, you could also run simulation days, you know? Now, what if you did enough priming around, maybe it was you'd get a senior, you know, vice president or whatever in there just to observe. That was enough now that the trainers in this scenario that we would put onto them, you know, certain positions tanking and do you or don't you hold and how quickly can we get that information from London? You know, the phone's down, you can't get that information. You could just layer it on. And whilst preparing that one scenario doesn't mean that you're bulletproof for everything, it does give you a chance to practice awareness, regulation, communication, a bit of ownership in following it up. And I feel that this opportunity is to raise the bar a bit, you know?
Yeah. I'm curious what your experience might reveal about the possibilities that are lying untapped right now, but that could get, you know, accelerated by some of these new tools and methods and, you know, disciplines we might bring into, you know, professional life, into business, you know, et cetera, from the following vantage point, which is that, you know, I sometimes kind of draw the analogy with like a ball machine in tennis, you know, throwing balls at you, right? That's the same thing with these simulations that you're talking about, right? And so it's constantly throwing you into various kinds of situations and you have to practice your forehand or you have to practice your backhand.
And that's how you develop muscle memory and you become comfortable and good with it. And I'm assuming that that's kind of now being stored in what you, in your model of the chimp, you know, model of the brain might be in the computer part of the brain, right? Like all these lived experiences now are being stored so you can access them at the right time. So the intrigue I have is, since this has never been done in leadership, communication, difficult conversations, inspiring people, motivating people, you know, those kinds of capacities that we need, you know, as a manager or leader, suddenly bringing this into the frame is going to unleash a whole wave of new capacities, humanity, that we had just told ourselves, you know, these people are not capable of, you know, this or that. But it's not that they were not capable. They just hadn't gotten the right equipment.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to be, I'd love to be in thinking groups, working groups on the front of that. You know, I mean, quite a number of years ago, there was questions around this, you know, how can we take things digital? How can we make it accessible? You know, how can we gamify? You know, the idea of gamifying things and making it sticky, I think was a big movement. And now with the introduction of AI, I wouldn't want to limit it by suggesting right now where I think it's going to go. You know, I think as you work with it and you explore each challenges together. I mean, some things that do jump out to me for sure is the ability to, as you said, interact with it, to give it challenges and for it to offer you some solutions is already something that's going to be accessible to a lot of people. So perhaps not everybody can get access to a very, maybe it's exclusive or whatever, limited number of performance psychologists. But then there is information out there and you can start to almost interact with AI a little bit and get some ideas. And but how would I do that? And how could I do that in 2 minutes? And yeah, but give me another example. You know, so I think the opportunity to interact is there. I love your idea of stimulus response training, you know, that tennis ball machine and the machine giving even us, the facilitators, we wouldn't necessarily be able to create what an AI can. So I quite like that. But at the same time, what I would temper that with is if we look at the ability to stop at times and actually ground ourselves and to remember what's really important and to make sure we've done that base level work, you know, back to that core, like who am I? What's important to me? Do I feel in control of that? The person is massively important in Formula One and every other performance sphere. The key people around them is massively important and those relationships and, you know, how we're getting the best out of that. And then often the team, so the wider team, the culture, the organism. So I'm sure AI and other resources can help us on all those three levels. But I feel sometimes that we always don't need to run before we're walking as well. You know, have we really pushed those three tiers, the person, the key relationships, the team, before we also go left field? You know, and I don't think it's one or. I think we can do them both.
Yeah.
But there's so much opportunity in the basics.
Yeah, no, I respect that very much. Thank you for also zooming out and, you know, helping us understand some of the other very core levers and starting that with just your own self as well, grounding in yourself. Let's go maybe from the prep work to the actual race, right?
Sure.
What are some of these folks who are really at the cutting edge of performance? What are they doing differently? What are they doing well? What disciplines and practices do they take on during the race, which could be translatable into our lives as well?
There was a question that you asked previously of one of your previous guests. I was really wanting to listen in and just get a real good flavor and just to stick to the question. It was about wisdom, you know, and kind of exploring wisdom and how it can be developed. And I started thinking about that myself. And I thought, you know, certainly for me, there's a bit about experiences there, you know, about kind of taking past experiences. Then there's the reviewing part of actually extracting meaning from it. You know, we all have loads of experiences, but we maybe don't stop to reflect on them. So actually stopping, reflecting, unpacking, learning. And then the third one, of course, is applying that. So you've had the experience, you've learned, but actually have you apply it in a way that means you actually improve future decisions. Now that's kind of wisdom, right? So I think that when I look at the drivers and many other high performing athletes, you know, obviously drivers are just one cohort that's of interest here. But when you look at them during, it's their ability to do that assessment and to think, right, where am I succeeding and why is that and what's working for me? But also, where am I not? You know, what is it? Is it my belief system? Do I have expectations that are triggering me in the car and I need to do that more belief-based work before I get in? I know we're talking about during, but at the end of the day, this is the work to better perform during. You need
members need to have done the work for it. So have I done that assessment of what I need to be thinking, feeling, doing in the car so that I can be at my best? That then informs your routines, you know, your refocusing strategies, how you communicate with your engineer, what communication do you need from them? How, again, do you regulate your emotion at certain key moments? What self-talk is in your head? You know, if we've got a long race, probably easier to go outside of F1 here. Let's go to Tour de France, you know, one of the most grueling cycling races in the world. You're going to ride your bike for near 21 days, well into the Alps at altitude. You're going to hit levels of exhaustion, which really are commonly understood to be dangerous for the body. So your brain is going to be telling you to stop, right? It has to. The self-talk has to be, oh my God, you know, we're going to blow. If we don't stop now, we're going to blow. What we see is that if you can train cyclists, even just amateur cyclists, helpful things to think, and they change that pre-planned thinking. Okay, when I get tired, this is what I'm going to think. I'm going to focus on the next 200 meters. I'm going to focus on just the rhythm of my feet, or I'm going to remind myself why I do this. They pre-program that thinking, that self-talk. Their success is higher. So all of these in-car techniques, routines, refocusing, communication, self-talk, I feel that they all come from the driver identifying where they need to change. You know, where's the opportunity for me to be better?
Amazing, amazing. I love that. So you plan in advance and you, based on past experiences, you understand what your derailers are, you understand where you get off track, and you create different sort of if-then rules in your brain, different sort of programming for how you're going to give a better response, you know, when those situations happen, rather than the chimp response.
Perfect. Yeah. And obviously that sounds, you know, for anyone kind of in the area or it's familiar, it sounds very cognitive behavioral. It sounds like, let's look at my beliefs, let's look at my behaviors, let's program them in and we'll optimize all this performance. There tends to be a big relatability for that in sport because it is quite clear and it's kind of like, okay, that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But obviously when we look at the neuroscience of it as well, when we test people, when they have a plan and they know what they're going to do, of course, those circuits tend to run faster because they're rehearsed, they're stronger, they're myelinated than not having that. So we're almost now looking at how do we move away from default survival to more optimal. So it is cognitive, it is behavioral, but the actual strategies,
yeah,
regulation, acceptance, refocusing, they come from ancient practices. You know, that they're things that we've done for millennium in different cultures. In some ways, they show up now in very, very elite sport.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful. You speak about intentional breaks that people need in their ability to hold their attention just constantly and consistently on one thing. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what that is?
Yeah, I think the way the brain is working is it's constantly scanning and taking multiple bits of information, and it's very, very efficient at cheating. You know, it's very, very efficient at saying, we won't focus on that part, that's not important. It chunks it all down and it makes it so that basically we can deal with the amount of stimulus that's coming into our brain. All right, so it's actually very super, super good, but it's cheating. You know, when somebody says to you, oh, hey, did you not see John? He just waved to you there. No, I didn't see it. I didn't see it. You know, if you could rewind every system, maybe I did see him, but he just wasn't in my frame of reference, right?
Yeah.
So often when we look at focusing, when people say, how do you focus for 2 hours in a race car with all this stimulation? Really, a key part of it is just learning to refocus. You know, it's not that you're going to focus for 2 hours, right? It's that you're going to have to refocus multiple times. Now, that could be the same in a competitive football match. You know, you might have an intention of how you're going to go out and be, but you might just say, hey, let's just do that for 10 minutes. Let's just focus on that for the first 10 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, I'm going to refocus. I'm almost going to go again and reset the brain. So the brain starts working in these more intentional, deliberate, chunked up ways. So there's right. The idea that to increase our focus, it can be helpful at times to almost intentionally break that cycle and refocus. But I also think from the New York Times perspective, I also meant the intentional break is around being deliberate with making sure you get your recovery. So it's actually more into that fourth area for me as well. Because at the end of the day, there's a myth that, you know, high performers, They just grind it out. They're nonstop. It's a relentless season. The season is relentless, but the truth is that recovery fuels performance. So at the end of the day, pushing harder isn't always the answer. Strategic recovery, actual deliberate breaks, are what sustains elite performance. So that now works in the car. Break that kind of pattern I'm in. Let's refocus, but also let's break this cycle of like plan, do, review, fly, and let's just take some time out. Let's recharge. Let's go to the woods with my kids and just walk and turn my phone off. Mm. Let's just breathe. And, you know, if necessary, let's get a bit of perspective on what's really important. I think that is also an intentional break for me, very deliberate.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's come back to the being in the flow of performance in the race itself. But since you brought up recharge, so earlier you had mentioned how you ultimately are there to be in service of every individual, you know, who you're supporting. And, you know, we're not all the same and everyone has their own unique sort of, you know, things that make them tick. So am I sort of correct in applying that principle to this notion of recharge by suggesting that what you're saying is that everyone needs to recharge? That's like one of those universal laws of human nature. But the way you recharge, you might find that needs to be customized for the individual, and that they might either walk in nature for some of them, and for some of them it might be something else. I mean, is that sort of how you approach it with your individual?
Yeah, if I were having the four areas and I was doing an assessment with the driver, I mean, obviously there's proper psychological assessment first, where I'm doing, you know, history and presenting factors, and again, combining my training fundamentally as a psychologist, then with performance elements. But I think once that's done, then we're now looking at performance and we're in this four-phase performance cycle. Every single phase has to be a needs assessment for that person. And you're right, therefore the tailoring is different. What I won't do is say, hey, look, in the car, the strategy you need to apply is self-talk and you need to use positive affirmations. Now, one person might just say to me, you're absolutely kidding me, Robbie.
No.
Don't relate to that psychology. I find that it distracts me from the task. And actually what we're recognizing is this person's far more about maybe his instructional self-talk. They need to be reminded to, hey, just you're overdriving at the minute, settle back. Overdriving means, you know, you're almost trying to push it too much. You're trying to find too much time and you're not actually getting the best out of the car. So one person's self-talk that works for them might actually really, really not be relevant to the person. And recharge is the exact same. And you're right. You know, if I said to somebody, the prescription is you have to go into the woods and be on your own, but they say, well, actually, no, I recharge from being with people. Ideally, my inner circle, who don't ask me a million questions about Formula One, but I like to be in a family unit and, you know, I like to be around a fire. You know, you get me by fire and I feel that warmth. I just absorb the warmth. Somebody else might say, I want to go diving and I want to get under the water because it just reminds me how small I am. So that recharge phase is very, very individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. When you talk about recharge, is that something like, what is the cadence that you have found to be really important for people to establish? Is it at one extreme, I think like once a year, or another extreme, it is once a day? So where, you know, what is critical?
I think a lot of people out there are still asking the same question of themselves. You know, they're probably still trying to work out that themselves. And I think there's levels that I try and explore with people whereby recharge is also a similar process here as happiness, whereby if you wanted to recharge, you kind of look at, when am I going to do that? So you might say, okay, me and my family, we're going to have a vacation. And there was some research I read recently, which is 8 days is the optimal amount of time to be away based on the kind of, by the time you get there and adjust versus the time that then you're kind of a bit familiar with that environment. And it's, you know, you kind of also want your home comforts to go back. So there's loads of stuff out there that will tell you where to go, when to go, and all the rest of it. But having that one time a year and thrashing me until then, I don't know if that's going to be enough for most people, right? I mean, people might say yes, but other people might say, no, I'm a double vacation person. Mm-hmm. Someone else might say, no, I'm about working 4 days a week and I have a 3-day weekend. So it gets individual for what it looks like. The constraints happen when obviously you work in a sport where you don't have that freedom, where there's very set windows when you can take time off and very high demand on you in between it. So I think for the Formula One drivers, we look at how do you recover even within a race weekend? So from like stint one through practice to when you're going like maybe it's into qualification. How can you reset there? Is it that you get in your private room? Is it meditation? You know, do you go and get that a chance to escape and just downregulate the system? You know, how do we then look between races? We haven't done it yet, but post-race number three is so important, because if you don't do it well, you'll probably never get to recharge. If you're always stuck in frustration or disappointment or questioning your performance, then that can carry on the whole week. And before you know it, you're racing again. Getting number three really good, where you debrief and you accept and you learn, it enables you to now go to your room and sleep or you know, recharge. So I think there is micro recharging.
Yes.
There is more kind of, hey, at this moment in time, I can't wait to go and recharge. And I think this is the thing with happiness, just to complete that point, whereby, sure, I'll be happy if I can achieve some of these goals in a year, but also just have two or three things, whether it's watching some comedy or speaking to an old friend, or, you know, like, I need to be able to access that now, because otherwise holiday in June is a long way away.
Yeah. Okay, great. There are a few different things you've talked about right now, which I just very quickly love to sort of reflect on. So you spoke about positive self-talk, and you even used a word that I am very familiar with from the spiritual, you know, sort of world of affirmations. And I love that, because it's something that I feel we tremendously undervalue, you know, in life. And yet it's like this free resource that any or all of us have to intentionally program our mind with certain words or phrases which are inspirational or directing us, you know, towards the right sort of, you know, end game in terms of our emotional state and our, you know, and our behavior. And I love that, like, that's, it sounds like that's a really key part of the machinery that they're using in high performance sports.
Yeah, again, I think when you look at some of the, maybe it's the most popular spoken about, you know, maybe it's because they are quite tangible. You know, you can read a book, and obviously we'll talk about it now. I think sports psychology for a long time was recognized or was believed to be just the training of psychological skills. And there was probably like five of them, you know, goal setting, self-talk, visualize, you know, it was like classic nuts and bolts sports psychology. And then they realized there was a lot more going on in terms of the psychological. So I think self-talk is a classic. For me, it's not just about being positive. I think that's quite important. You know, it is about being constructive. So it is about making sure that the inner narrative is constructive. Now, if we think about effective uses of that, as I said, it could be that you're like quite instructional. So you're giving yourself something tactical. So if I'm a defender in rugby and I'm a bit worried about making these tackles because these guys are pretty big, I'm sure it's the same in American football. You know, it might be that for a little while I just work on some, you know, visual cues, but in my head I'm like, stay low, stay strong, stay low, stay strong, stay low, stay strong. And that narrative is just overriding any interference from, oh, I'm not going to make the tackle and what if I get rolled over? And, you know, so I'm just deliberately saying stay low, stay strong is very instructional and helpful for me. Somebody else might feel that actually they want it to be slightly more motivational. You know, they might feel that actually, I saw some footage of Ronaldo, you know, footballer, and he's stood there before he does his free kick, and the lip readers have translated what he says, and he's saying, I've got this, I will score. I've got this, I will score. I cannot go and tell people I work with that that's the affirmation that they need to use, because some people will tell me, that doesn't help me, Robbie. It distracts me, it puts pressure on me. I don't want to try and predict the future. Yeah. So that motivational stuff. But I do think you can have a neutral one. I could stand over the ball or before the board meeting. Actually, I don't mind sharing this for the audience from my own experience, but I still get a really high adrenaline response when I'm going to talk to big audiences. And that adrenaline response for me would show up like, you know, the classic heart rate and maybe his hands are a bit sticky. Now, I've learned that I believe that that is a healthy offer from my brain, just saying, hey, be careful. Are we sure about this? And now my self-talk would very much be around, okay, my heart's increasing, my body's ready.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. 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 So that's that true self with the chimp and befriending the chimp and honoring, you know.
Yeah. But I guess the key, what would be one of the messages there for people would be to stop and first and foremost become aware of some of your self-talk, to actually become aware of it. I would definitely ask some athletes to you know, keep it so hard to keep a journal when you're during a game and certainly in a car, but they'll come out and they can tell you critical moments and some of the thoughts. So I think number one for the population is to become aware of it and realize you've got a choice to change it. And then the second thing is to train it so that your inner voice is like a coach, not a critic.
Ah, beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Wow. You know, it's incredible, right? The amount of possibilities we have in each of us to keep sculpting ourselves. And that's what you are. You're a master sculptor. You know, you're a master.
Well, I'm just another person trying to do my best as well. And I love it when you get with somebody who's curious and they're interested and they want to explore it and they bring you their thoughts once you get that relationship. And like I said, I can't read their mind. I don't know what they're thinking. That's once you work with somebody who's open to the idea of exploring what they can try and do, now we can really have a go, you know? And I feel that sometimes I don't have those answers. I 100% don't have them. I'll say to them, okay, let me have a think about this. Do you mind if I come back tomorrow, you know? Somebody asked me the other day if I want to write a book and I said, God, no, not yet. I said, like, maybe it's in a while. I said, I'm having too much fun cracking on for now.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes I look at those of us who are at the cutting edge of practice, you know, which is what I see you, you know, doing for folks in the sports world and beyond. And I like to say, you know, you're like the living scripture. You know, there's some people who write the scripture, study the scriptures, but you're like a living scripture. You know, the book that you're writing is, you know, the great outcomes, breakthroughs, performance that you're able to activate in everybody. And another metaphor that's coming to my mind is, because I talked about sculpting for a minute here, is Michelangelo. I don't know if you know, but like, so he would say sometimes that, you know, to me, like, sculpting is just, you know, the pure, beautiful form was already within the stone. And all I was doing was basically just chipping off the excess, you know, stone to get that beautiful form. And so I was visualizing you with all these sort of, coaches of yours, you know, in their own sort of, you know, high performing and super talented way, but you're helping them discover, you know, their beautiful statue within their true self and, you know, equipping them with the tools through which they can do a little bit of that chipping away. But you're not imposing, this is one thing I really am carrying from our conversation today. You know, you're not imposing your view of what that statue is within them. You're helping them become aware of what their own, you know, intuitive pull is towards their true self.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. That's a really beautiful way. And I'd hope most people, I say most because I can't speak for everybody, but I hope most people in the coaching and the psychology space, once they do enough of it, I think they start to realize that that's the only way to do it. You know, let me be fair. When you're obviously, for obvious reasons, early on, maybe in your career, it helps to have framework and to have structure, maybe to have a program. You know, helps because it gives you security, you know, that I've got something I can go through. And then, of course, you just realize that, oh yeah, but now I have to add this on, I have to add it. And it becomes so big that you think, God, I can't even have a framework. And then you feel more comfortable to move. But having things like a good assessment and a four-phase performance model or those three levels, the individual, key relationships, team, you know, all these things that you can give so that the other person can see some direction. That's the balance, isn't it? You want to give them some ideas without telling them which way they're going, right? You know?
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. I sometimes when wanting to express my gratitude and, you know, getting to meet somebody again and want to thank them or just, you know, share my affection, I'll give them a gift. You know, we all do. I'm not as good as it as I should be, but I try to see if I can bring that gift, you know, from India, because that makes me feel connected with these two worlds that have been so formative in my life, you know, the East and the West, you know, India and the United States. And so I want to give you a gift from India, Ravi, at the end of this, you know, journey, this beautiful journey that you've taken us on. And we're in this virtual space, you and me. So I have to transmit it more through the digital world. And so it has to be a thought gift, you know, it can't be like a material gift, but here is what I could, you know, I think offer to you, which I think I can honestly say, you know, has for me been a gift from India. And that is the following, which is, you described this beautiful model, right? That Steve and you practice around the chimp model. And I really find that quite helpful. And I hope that many of our readers will take much from it, right? The emotional surges that sometimes we get, and that's the chimp part. If I understand you correct, there's the true self, the human self that can analyze and step back and reason and be rational and thoughtful about it. And then there's the computer, which is generating a lot of data, you know, from all your experiences, and therefore allowing you to, from time to time, become wiser and smarter and more prepared, you know, with every investment you make in building out this computer, right? Is that like a fair paraphrasing of
that? Yeah.
So I want to propose, and I want to add, and that's my gift from India, is like a fourth component to that.
Yep.
Yeah. And the fourth component I want to add is that your brain may also, you never know, right? And let's see what the science of tomorrow says. But your brain may also be a browser. Maybe it is a portal to some form of infinite wisdom in the universe. At some level, I first got that when I was hanging around in Botswana. You know, we were doing some safari and it was beautiful, very inspiring. The flora and fauna and these majestic animals, you know, the lions and the elephants. And ultimately, I converged on this like termite hill, you know, these massive monuments to the hard work of at times 50, 60 generations of termites, you know, who each die like within a year or so. But then after about 60 years, you get this massive mound, you know, that they've produced. And I asked the guide there as to, you know, tell me more. And there are these very intricate tunnels and almost like air conditioning and things they build inside them. And some of them are like soldier termites and some of them are like construction worker termites and all. And I was like, it blew my mind. That little tiny little insects, you know, and I was just thinking like, wow, you know, they don't have any sports academies. They don't have any, you know, universities, you know, these are just termites. But somehow they're born with the innate genius through which to contribute generation by generation to the building of something that ultimately becomes a haven, you know, for their community. And millions of termites are apparently then one of these, you know, termite hills. Anyway, so this notion of, you know, the brain as a browser and, you know, that's, it's a very kind of like a mystic, you know, almost like a spiritual, like sort of model, you know, of the brain. And I was thinking back to your world and the person that came to mind is, you know, I mean, I haven't had a huge foray in the Formula One racing world, but I did really love learning and studying Senna, this Brazilian car race driver who, you know, died, you know, painfully early through an accident, but also was an incredible world champion in that space. And he talked about how, you know, driving for him, sometimes he would just get into the zone where he was in a different dimension and way over his limit, he says, and still able to find more, you know, and I said, like, he said, like, I frightened me because I felt like I was, you know, way beyond my conscious understanding. And I've seen that sort of like painters talk about it, like Picasso, that somebody else paints through me, or, you know, Puccini in compositions of operas that, like, you know, it's like I just wield the pen, but somebody else is writing through me. And, you know, anyway, so that's my intrigue that, you know, you never know, but maybe what you're activating for some of these folks, if they're truly impassioned about it and putting the ego aside and just striving to be the best version, but also meeting the moment with these thousand variables, I can't imagine, you know, how you're doing that without a little bit of almost like cosmic intelligence flowing through you.
I mean, the thing you've made me really reflect on that, and thanks for that. It is genuinely, one of the reasons, I don't know how other people feel about public speaking or podcasts or otherwise, but you know, one of the reasons I 100% was happy to come on is I just knew we'd have a good conversation. Yeah. You know, I was like keen to interact and learn. So already there's another thing you've given me right there. And what it's made me go off straight away in my head was that point about wisdom earlier. I think everyone has the capacity to develop some more wisdom, but obviously not everyone actually does it. And
right.
For me, I think when I reflect on why that might be, you know, one of the biggest barriers to that is rigidity. You know, it's people who stick to their beliefs.
Right.
Despite new evidence, who aren't willing to take some feedback or in this particular example, a suggestion, you know? Yeah. So, whereas we know on the other hand, people who embrace that kind of openness, who seek out different perspectives, who say, actually, how is this model not complete? And what else might we be missing? And wow, there's a whole other, right, let's go and explore that. And let's see how we can, then I think, that's where we accelerate our opportunity for growth. You know? And yeah, for sure. I really welcome it. Genuinely, I'd be curious to look more into it. I think, you know, we don't just go through our experiences, right? The good performers, the top performers, not don't just go through it, kind of actively extracting, adjusting, improving. So yeah, I really welcome that.
Oh, thank you. No, that's so gracious of you. So gracious. So as we then bring it to closure, first of all, thank you so much. This has been a real joy. And exhilarating, you know, I think exhilarating in many ways to stand, you know, to walk in the shoes, you know, some of your coaches, you know, to feel that sense of complexity and competition and yet sort of a co-creation that is happening between them on the inside and their world on the outside to unfold high performance. So thank you for everything you've shared with us today. To close it out, could you share what you're most aspiring for in life in the years ahead? What's your big dream?
Yeah, that's a lovely question.
I think it goes straight the way back to me, to my kind of core, who I am and what I currently, you know, I'm very clear that's important to me. You know, I mean, I boiled myself at the moment down to three values again, leaving that space to grow and adapt. But I think care is the big one of my primary, and I put my family at the top of that list. So I'm very fortunate enough to have a young, just under 2-year-old boy. So I see the next few years growing that and just following him on his journey and being a huge part of that with my wife. And so already there's that very kind of caring part. Then I think about that in the sport world and the people I'm working with and trying to help them actualize themselves and their dreams. So that's a big part. Ties hugely into my second core value, which is adventure. Adventure for me is an umbrella term for growth and trying new things. And it's a big world, or it's a small world, whichever way we look at it, you know? So I think there's a lot of that in the next few years, opportunities to meet new people, take on new challenges, experience new things. And then the third one for me would be, again, it's probably a simple one, but it's just to be happy in the simplest way. Be grateful for what I've got, stay grounded, be kind of, like I said, open-minded. So I think for me, that isn't a grand plan. There isn't a destination that I feel if I get there, then I'm done. I don't work in that way. I think it's just to be really here, enjoy it, have a bit of a guidance for those values, and make the most of it.
Beautiful. I love that. Care, adventure, and happiness. Wonderful. Wishing you all the best, Robbie, in your journey ahead. I sense that there are many luminous chapters still to be written, and that even perhaps you may have an inkling, but not really a tangible form yet that you've given it as to what those might be. So truly, I think life for you is going to be an adventure full of a lot of pathways to happiness. And, you know, and I'm so grateful that caring is such a core part of what it is that you're aspiring for as well. Because in the kinds of times we live in today, you know, when you talk about rigidity and the need for self-renewal, I think care would be, you know, another of those great values, you know, that we can take some inspiration, you know, from you having sort of ended our podcast with that. So thank you.